Blog Talk Radio.
6 Degrees is another fine show brought to you by Law of Attraction Radio Network.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
We are all connected by just 6 degrees of separation. Somehow, some way, we just need to open up the dialogue to see where our connections lie. Welcome to the 6 Degrees Show with your host, Anthony Bryce.
Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, and good night. This is Anthony Bryce, the host of 6 Degrees. 6 Degrees is about connecting, and we are all connected. Somehow, some way, it's through the dialogue that those essential connections are revealed. And today, for the first time on 6 Degrees, we have Stephen Myers. Stephen Myers, he's an author, lecturer, and independent researcher. He studied the Great Pyramid for over 20 years to understand how this ancient wonder of the world was built and why. His research included traveling to Egypt to conduct extensive on-site research at the Giza Plateau. Stephen's written numerous magazine articles and given many lectures on the subject of the Great Pyramid. Compiling his research into the book called Lost Technologies of the Great Pyramid, How the Great Pyramid Was Built, Stephen has provided a comprehensive and detailed explanation of how the Great Pyramid was built. And later on, this is Stephen Myers. Stephen Myers, this is The World on 6 Degrees. How are you doing tonight? Oh, it might help if I brought him on in. There you go, Stephen. How are you doing tonight?
Really good. Thank you for this opportunity to letting me be on your show.
Oh, Stephen, it is an absolute honor. The pleasure and the honor is mine. You're very welcome. For the live listeners, the call-in number is 646-915-9567. And for the people in the chat room, you can just go ahead and type on away any questions that you have during this interview process. Stephen, for people who want to dive in a little bit deeper into your rabbit hole, what is a good website for them to reference while they're listening to this podcast?
Well, an excellent website would be the website for the nonprofit foundation that I established concerning how the Great Pyramid was built and why. The web address for that website is www.thepump.org. thepump.org. And there you'll find information about what we're doing and also the book.
Well, that's wonderful. There you have it, folks. Stephen, you know, while I was just before the show, I always go into meditation. And while I was trying to remember where in the world we first linked up. I just couldn't remember. Do you remember?
Were you and I linked up?
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I think it was through email, probably.
Oh, well, doesn't matter. All I know is your subject matter is transformative. I have to say, your approach and the information that you bring out in your book, Lost Technologies of the Great Pyramid, How the Great Pyramid Was Built, is world transformative. As people learn to utilize and to think the way you think, and we're going to get into this. Hold on one second. excuse me, we're going to get into this very, very specifically in a moment. Before we begin, I would just like to know a little bit of your background. Where are you from, and what got you interested in pyramids?
Well, our foundation is located out here on the Oregon coast. And anyway, I have a very technical background with technology, electronics, that type of thing. I'm even my hobbies are quite technical in nature. I collect antique gasoline engines, which is quite interesting. And I also am an amateur radio operator. So technology has been very interesting to me. And I also am interested in history. So if a person likes technology and history, ultimately their attention will focus on the Great Pyramid, because it's certainly a historical building, but also quite technological. It's a 45-story tall skyscraper. So I started to study the Great Pyramid, and certainly read the conventional ideas, the current conventional ideas about a big ramp that must have been bigger than the Great Pyramid itself. And then I also read about people dragging stones, and I read about the great extreme precision that Egyptologists talk about that was done by hand tools, the precision of many of the stones. And I thought that was very remarkable claims. So I looked into, instead of just accepting what they said, I looked into what their demonstrations were, what their proofs were. And I found out something that a lot of people don't realize that is not in books about Egyptology, but they don't have any demonstrations. They have not exercised scientific method, been involved in the scientific method. A casing-sized stone is 16 tons. The science of Egyptology can't move a 16-ton payload 1 inch. It's never been done since the inception of Egyptology. They've never moved a heavy stone around the corner of a spiral ramp. Isn't that interesting?
It is interesting how...
Yes,
well,
it
you
is.
Know, it's not just... The only, speaking of the Great Pyramid, 45 stories tall. You know, I think this is how we connected. I don't know, but I've always had, I'm sure like quite a many people in the world, an attraction to the pyramid, to the Great Pyramid.
Oh, certainly.
But I've never seen it. Go ahead.
It's the mystery of the ages.
Well, it's not just the only remaining example of the Seven Wonders of the Ancient World. It's probably the world's greatest historical architectural enigma. That's straight from your book.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I agree with you. And it's real interesting. What we've done at our foundation is conducted a bunch of research, starting with a new slate. You know, we're not worried about the pharaohs or the king's lists or mummies or ramps. We just want to understand it in terms of a technological focus. You know, it doesn't matter what gods they worshipped, whoever built the Great Pyramid, because the gods didn't assemble it. Humans did, just like us. And it doesn't matter what their religions were or what their language was. So we started with a clean slate and stripped away all of the preconceived notions and all of the presuppositions and all of that, all of the untruths that are taught as truths, and looked at it with new eyes and determined a very different construction method than is generally accepted. And we believe that that construction method utilized the buoyancy of water and water locks like the Erie Canal or the Panama Canal, and that moves stones from the Nile River all the way up to the building site.
Well, you know, I love this quote that you have in your book, The Lost Technologies, the lost Technologies of the Great Pyramid. It's from Aristotle. It is the mark of an educated mind to be able to entertain a thought without accepting it.
Certainly. certainly. And that's what Aristotle, that's the truth from Aristotle's time up till now. For people to learn something, they need to entertain a thought or an idea and come to understand it. And that's what I hope people can do, because there's a lot of preconceived notions and a lot of ideas. People already know about the Great Pyramid, but what we contend at our foundation and through the book is that much of what they know is incorrect. And it's very difficult for people to unlearn something they already know.
You know, it's interesting the perspectives that you've brought out here in your book. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier in the very, very beginning of the show, your, you know, the ideas and the things that you're, I hate to use the word things, but as the interview develops, people will kind of understand where we're going with this. It really is world transformative, because, you know, the ancient civilizations, they saw the Great Pyramid not as a mystery, but as a wonderful achievement. You know, they were already there. Why did you bring this perspective? Did we lose you? Oh, we lost Stephen. Well, isn't that something? Well, Stephen, since we lost you, please call back in at 646-915-9567. Somehow we lost you, but we got him back now. Stephen, did you hear the question?
We're out here in Oregon, but what was the question?
Well, the question was, the ancient civilization saw the Great Pyramid as a not as a mystery, but as a wonderful, wonderful achievement. And you know,
yes.
The reason I'm saying that is because modern day times, you know, we see it as this huge enigma. But 5,000. First off, how old is the dang thing?
Well, its age is certainly under scholarly debate, but and that is actually not the focus of our research, when it was made. But generally, it's considered about 4,500 years old. But when it was made is not the focus. The main focus with us is how it was made. And the two are certainly quite different. But the original builders who envisioned the Great Pyramid decided to build it and then committed their energies to building it, understood why they wanted to do it. But to us, we know in our times less than what they know, because it's a mystery, generally, in modern times, why the Great Pyramid was built. Most Egyptologists contend it was a tomb, but that's just a story that they're telling.
Hmm. So, I mean, how did we go from a civilization that's able to manifest something 45 stories tall with the marvel and the beauty and the wonder of it that it is, then we go to barbarians, and now we're even worse than barbarians. We're earth killers. I mean, come on, what's going on?
I understand where you're coming from. Evidently, based on the direct physical evidence of the Great Pyramid, much of it is the result of extremely high technology. Just because it's ancient doesn't mean that it's primitive. And just because it's made out of stone doesn't mean that it's stone age, if you will. It's quite sophisticated. Much of the construction requirements cannot be demonstrated in modern times, especially the way Egyptologists say it was done. That's just people are becoming aware that that's just hokum. It's just a story. It's a fairy tale.
What happened, Stephen? What happened?
What happened? Ultimately, what happened? I think that it was probably it was built pre last catastrophe. There's a idea that the Earth is punctuated by catastrophes. One destroyed the killed off the dinosaurs. possibly a religious idea is that there was a flood that was a catastrophe. Many people feel that the Great Pyramid is much older than traditionally thought by Egyptologists, because the civilization of ancient Egypt doesn't seem to be able to be able to make the components even of the Great Pyramid. So possibly there was a thriving civilization with high technology, probably much different than we have, and probably there was a catastrophe. And then after that, civilization restarted, if you will, with hunter-gatherers, and then developed up to whatever we are. It's a similar idea with 2012, that a lot of people think in a few years there might be another restarting of the Earth civilization or coming into a new age. So the Great Pyramid may be before the beginning of our age, if you will. So that's a theory about when it came to be.
Well, you know, it does kind of make a lot of sense, too, because you made mention in your book how a lot the Egyptologists and the people who find these artifacts and unearth them, they try to figure out what they are, and actually what ends up happening is there's just institutionalized self-perpetuating ignorance.
Yes, I agree with you. True. It's the mark of a good, especially Egyptologist, to find an artifact and then to interpret it. But it's the interpretation is different than the direct physical evidence. It is just like I say, an interpretation. Here's an interesting thing that we're doing at the foundation. Among other things, we're doing a lot of things that's indicated on our website, but we have a scholarship. It's a $50,000 scholarship, and all the people have to do is make 5 casing stones and move them about 100 yards, and then have to move them on and off a barge, because Egyptologists say that the original builders did that. And then stack them up, a row of 3 and then 2 on top. And Egyptologists say that a stone was moved 1 every 2 minutes, so that based on that, it's 10 minutes work, $50,000. That's open to anybody, any college, any university, any author, any private party, any group, any church organization. So we have this scholarship that we're trying to jumpstart Egyptology, at least bring them up to the 19th century, to try to encourage them to engage in the scientific method and show us all of their books, show how it was done. Working people, you know, made casing stones that are extremely precise to about 1/50th of an inch over a surface of 5 by 7 feet. But there hasn't been any takers for this scholarship. So if any of your listeners is interested in, making Egyptology, putting their feet to the fire, then maybe somebody can demonstrate what books in every library in the world say was done about how the stones were moved, because it's never been demonstrated. So that's one thing that we're doing.
So what is you say this word casing stone for my grandson who's listening to this show? What is a casing stone?
The Great Pyramid, as it is now, looks quite rough. But when newly built, it had what they call casing stones, which were quite precise and quite large, up to 16 tons. There's some still remaining at the Great Pyramid, but it used to be covered with sheathing of casing stones, and we're just using them as an example. They were set in place and, in fact, cemented together to make a watertight seal after, you know, they were cut very precise, cemented together. And that's just an example of some rather remarkable construction abilities that Egyptologists cannot recreate. So that's why we've developed a scholarship to try and promote Egyptology to enter into the scientific method and make a demonstration of what they say. But anyway, what our alternative theory is to this big ramp that has never been demonstrated, moving a 70-ton. The largest stones in the Great Pyramid are 70 tons. Egyptologists have never moved one of those stones even 1 inch. Any payload of that size, like a locomotive or an A1 tank, a military tank, they weigh both about 70 tons, and they've never moved one of those even 1 inch. So because of their lack of scientific method, there's been a whole controversy about how the Great Pyramid was built. And our alternative idea is that it was made using these water locks. The stones on barges were able to go right to the building site up a series of water locks. And the first level of casing stones were set in place first, cemented together with a water lock in the wall of casing stones, and that impounded a pond, if you can imagine, that was where the Great Pyramid is, and the stones on barges went right up into that pond, and then were put in the interior stones were put in that pond and filled the pond up with stones, and then the first level of the Great Pyramid was completed. Then they continued the process and built the Great Pyramid level by level until it rose to the sky. So that's our theory, and there's information about that on our website. And the book is fairly well illustrated on the construction technique.
Mm-hmm. Very, very well illustrated. So do you have, Stephen, any demonstrable proof of your hypothesis?
There's a bunch of evidences that indicates that we're correct, if I can say that. The casing stones, again, were cemented in place. And the ones that still exist at the Great Pyramid are watertight. The joints between them, after at least 45 centuries, are still watertight. We think we interpret that. That's evidence. We have an interpretation of it. The purpose of that is not to keep the pharaoh's soul from leaking out, but it's to keep water from leaking out. Also, around the Great Pyramid are boat pits, and the sun ship was found right at the base of the Great Pyramid, and there's a twin sun ship that is still buried right next to the one that was excavated in 1953. So there's boats at the Great Pyramid, which is quite interesting. And there was a wall around the Great Pyramid that we felt was used to impound water during the construction process. That wall is gone. It was removed in the 19th century. Early drawings of the Great Pyramid depict that wall about 30 feet high. Egyptologists have a different interpretation of that same evidence. They say it was to keep the unwashed masses away from the sacred Great Pyramid. So, and then there's a whole host of other things. Inside the Great Pyramid was found by Petrie in the 1890s, what he called Nile Earth, and what that means in modern language is mud. He found a dried mud or sediment inside the Great Pyramid, which is quite provocative. And also the design doesn't seem to be of the Great Pyramid, has many chambers and passages, and there's great precision, and it doesn't appear to be a tomb. In fact, Egyptologists, because the Great Pyramid doesn't look like a tomb, say there must have been a change in plans, because what the Great Pyramid looks like isn't what they think it is. So there must have been a change of plans during construction. Well, the several rooms in the Great Pyramid were conducive to what we think the purpose of the Great Pyramid was, which was to be an infrastructure for the civilization that built it, and it was to be a active machine that pumped water. And that's what we think the Great Pyramid was for was a massive, industrially scaled water pump.
Mm. Well, the orientation, you know, there's a lot of speculation and interpretation of the orientation of the pyramids to the stars and the summer and vernal equinox phenomenon. Mm-hmm. Now, I know there's some real evidence of the summer and the vernal equinox phenomenon and the alignment. Is there any proof behind that, or is that just hogwash?
Well, there is evidence that the vents, to make a whole long story short, the vents point to some stars. They don't point to those stars now, very specific stars, because of the precession of the equinoxes, general precession, the stars move across the sky. So 4,500 years ago, those vents pointed to stars that people thought was important. But you have to remember, the Empire State Building, the very tippy top of it, it points to a star. And the crown of the Statue of Liberty has seven points, and they all point to stars. Did you know that?
Mm-mm.
Anything that points up points to stars. And, okay? Flagpoles, the pins in my pencil cup on my desk, you know, the antenna on my car, they all point to stars.
Get out of here, for reals.
Yeah, but the question is there a causal relationship? People have an interpretation, and some people, there's some authors that have gotten a lot of mileage out of that. But, you can say, well, the Book of the Dead refers to these stars and the vents point to stars, and you can say all that. But you have to remember, all of those people that have that idea look at the Great Pyramid as an already completed structure and try to divine some sort of meaning from it. Because it's such a mystery, all of these different ideas are trying to divine or interpret what the Great Pyramid is. And with us starting as a clean slate, we feel that it's necessary that the understanding of the Great Pyramid has to have two primary things. It has to understand how it was built and also why it was built. And those two things have to be consistent with each other and have to be consistent with the direct physical evidence. But there's a speculation that they do, but even if they did point to stars, those same authors and researchers and proponents of a star alignment theory have no answer to how big, heavy stones were moved from point A to point B. So their stories, to me, are inconsistent for a comprehensive understanding of the Great Pyramid. Even if they did point to stars, you still got to move the stones. And we think that the lower chamber of the Great Pyramid, cut in the solid bedrock and associated passages down there, were a kind of water pump that served to supply water to the water locks and allow the Great Pyramid to be constructed. And then we also feel that the upper passages and chambers, King's and Queen's Chamber and the Grand Gallery, were an additional water pump, and they both acted in series, first the lower one and then the second one, and the output of this water pump was out the King's Chamber's vents. And that's our understanding of this ancient but high technology. And we also feel that this is an important alternative to being on our addiction to oil and all of this, is to have an alternative method to pump water, and it would serve two purposes in our civilization. One, for irrigation, and also to generate electricity. So we're trying to develop this ancient but high technology for our modern but troubled world.
Mm. You know, there's a devotion to an outdated thought processes and not just outdated, but just skewed. You know, you brought that to very clear terms in your book when you it was toward the beginning. I think you gave the analogies, actually a whole series of analogies that go throughout your book. Using the unearthed 1954 car that they found. In 1845, they unearthed the 1954 car, and then can you just kind of go over that? Not too much of going into the book in detail, but it's a very important key to understanding things.
Okay, in my book, I had a little story, an illustration, which is sort of like a mental exercise, if you will, but a in this story, in the 1830s or whenever, they found a car that was like a 1950 Chevy, okay, that people know about. Well, what would happen if that really happened? Well, the people that found it, they would analyze the car and talk about alignments and talk about symbology because they never seen a car or an internal combustion engine. Well, the all of these ideas would be validated by unanimity of opinion, you know, by other experts and stuff. And then I said that what if somebody said no, and that's a mechanical device that can move by itself, you know, with a fuel, and that a person that suggested that, and it's more elaborate in the book. But that person would be considered, a fool or a charlatan, and be excommunicated from the scientific world. Well, there was such a guy, and that guy was Edward Kunkel, who was the originator of the idea that the Great Pyramid was built with water locks, and also that it was a water pump. And he wrote a self-published, an obscure small booklet called Pharaoh's Pump, and that's the basis of our research. But I appreciate the kind words about that story, and it illustrates some interesting points. But the Great Pyramid is kind of an out-of-place artifact. It's out of place based on our understanding of it. You know, it's out of place because we look at it for symbolic meaning or Bible prophecy, but it's a technological wonder that was actually built in a technical manner to serve a technical purpose. So that's what, with some several different illustrations in the book, I talk about those things. The book isn't just about how the Great Pyramid was built, but also about how to think about something that you've already thought about, how to rethink about it. And I appreciate your kind words, but I've been getting, it was quite an effort to write the book, and I've been getting a lot of really good positive feedback, and it means a lot to me.
Well, as well as you should, because it forces the reader and it forces academia, it forces the people, anyone who takes the time to read this book to look at, to shift the world view. It really, really does. I know it forced me to shift my world view because it made me think, you know, the artifacts that are coming out of ancient times really are more advanced than what we have today. And we, in our arrogance, our civilization's arrogance, thinking that we were better than them, and when actually we have devolved instead of evolved, have kind of misinterpreted things. And like in your story with the car, you know, the windshield was called a window to the afterlife. You know,
right? Yeah, I understand. Yeah, there actually in the Middle East, there's a lot of real technical wonders from ancient times. The Baghdad Battery is a good example.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the largest stones that were ever moved is from the Middle East. So it's I think we've lost a lot of understanding. If I may be so bold to say this, the reason why I'm getting out on a limb here, but I think the reason why modern man is so very arrogant and the scholarly world is so very arrogant is that they're not going to say that ancient Africans were geniuses. I'm just putting that out there. And it's a difficult thing to say here in the 21st century, but I think that's something that academia has to work on. But yes, the Great Pyramid was built in Africa, and there were ancient Africans who were very advanced, and rightly so. And my book wants to give glory to the people that built the Great Pyramid. So that's just another issue that's involved with the arrogance of the scientific community. We also want to tell people that the Great Pyramid is not just glory to the ancients, but it's a vision for our future, because it's a technology that I think will help us if we can get it redeveloped in modern times. So that's what our foundation is all about. We're a nonprofit foundation, both educational and research, trying to redevelop this ancient technology for modern times.
You know what I also found interesting, which also helped to shift my worldview and perspective, is how modern man, quote unquote modern man, since I've read a big portion of your book, don't think we're as modern as we are as we used to be, but the naming of the whole area, the Giza Necropolis, you know, that's just the naming of the area clouded everyone's judgment and approach to anything that came from there.
I agree. Well, much of the interpretation is quite skewed, I think. Many of the tombs, let's say, were from the 4th dynasty that are around the Great Pyramid, but that doesn't mean that's when the Great Pyramid was built. There's a place called Independence Rock that was on the Oregon Trail, and a number of people were buried there because it was a very important landmark along the Oregon Trail. Well, that doesn't mean when they were buried there is not when that rock was built or whatever. You know what I'm trying to say? So there's a lot of
I think people wanted to be buried there because they spent so much of their life.
Well, because it was so marvelous. Yes. Yeah. And then it's attributed to a specific pharaoh. But if I was a leader in that era, and the Great Pyramid, let's say, was right over there, there's this big pyramid over there, and I'm the leader, you know what I'd say? That's my pyramid, and I'll take the credit for it. That's the way leaders do. They do that now. So
I found it interesting. Also, back in the ancient, quote-unquote, ancient Greek times, the pyramid was considered an ancient monument.
Absolutely. Yes, the 5th century B.C. Herodotus visited the Great Pyramid, and it was ancient then. And he was told by the priests, which were probably tour guides, about a machine that used short wooden planks to lift the stones up to where their final resting place. Well, a lot of people interpret that as being levers. Well, you can't move a 70-ton stone with levers. You can't do it. So, but if they use water locks, the water locks on the Erie Canal had short wooden planks for doors. So it's kind of interesting. And our book goes through a whole series of different ways of looking at things, and about how the ancients were a lot smarter than we think they are, and we may not be as smart as we think we are. Those are some of the themes in the book. And again, I appreciate your kind words.
Well, it really does force the reader to shift their worldview and it transform. You know, and when you shift your worldview, on an individual level, and your self and your environment being so inextricably connected, it does tend to shift the world as well. You know, and that's the power of your book, Stephen. If you don't mind, let's go into a little narrow focus and take a trip inside of the pyramid. And there's our markings. And are any of the original markings on the pyramid verified? And have they been translated?
Well, there was reports that were a lot of markings or writings on the casing stones, but probably that was graffiti, and those stones have been removed. In the relieving chambers above the king's chamber are some markings of various type. They are not formal. They are like what they're termed as quarry marks. And a lot of those are some symbols and some writing, and most of those people agree were done before the stones were set in place, because they're not contiguous. Like, it's not like some formal thing was written after the stones were set in place, but probably when the stones were in the quarries. So there's a few markings. Also in the subterranean chamber, there was some Greek era and Roman era graffiti. But the Great Pyramid had no formal markings in it whatsoever inside the passages and chambers. There was no utterances from the Book of the Dead. There was no symbol of a star. There was no markings at all. You want to know why?
Of course.
Because it didn't need any. It wasn't the intent of the original buildings to put markings in there, because those passages and chambers were full of water. Just like in the cylinders of your car, there was no writing in there to tell anybody anything. You know, it was a functional machine. It didn't need writing inside. Tombs had writing inside all over them. And the temples had writing inside and out all over them. I mean, they wrote like you wouldn't believe. But the Great Pyramid, no writing.
You know, it's interesting how your before I get right into this next question, I want you to talk about how the Hoover Dam, about your experience with the Hoover Dam.
Oh, that I had a little story about the Hoover Dam, yes.
Yeah, that'll help lead in.
Okay. The Hoover Dam's a marvelous thing. We toured it. You know, it's like a cathedral in stone. It's it's just sitting there making electricity, built in the 1930s with mostly concrete, but magnificent. Well, part of the tour included going through this access tunnel that was very primitively built. And so I asked the tour guide, I said, what's the story here? You know, the rest of the Great Pyramid, or the rest of the Hoover Dam is exquisite, but this passage is very primitive. Why? And he says, well, the passage was made much later than when the Great, I did it again. When the Hoover Dam was built, it was built in the 30s, and it was built with excellent craftsmanship. But this later passage was built much later, and the specs were not as precise, and it was good enough, and it passed inspection, and there you are. But it was an obvious difference. So there's an idea that the farther back you go, the more primitive things are. Well, that may not be true, because it's certainly not true with the Hoover Dam. Because the older part of the dam was made with greater precision than the newer part. So Egyptologists look at different pyramids to determine the sequence of their construction, and they say, this pyramid here was built real primitive, so it must have came first. Then this one here was built much more precise. Oh, it must have came later, because the quality of craftsmanship is better, so he must have evolved. Well, there's several illustrations in the book that say that that isn't necessarily so, and the Hoover Dam was one of those illustrations.
Mm-hmm. That's it. Now, thank you, Stephen, so much for sharing that story, because that was a huge eye-opener for me as well, because it forced me really to put all of my thoughts about ancient times upside down. You know, and not just ancient times, but just any sequence of events. And you can't really, you can't tell a book by its cover, bottom line. But I was left, Stephen, with a lot of questions, you know, just like a lot of people are. And, you know, you talk about how the pyramids built, but then there's these sciences that they use, like the bonding agents. You know, they can't even replicate those now. What's up with that?
That's correct. There was a very extreme bonding agent that cemented together the casing stones and some of the other stones in the Grand Gallery and whatever. And that is under scholarly debate what that material was. It was between the stones, and the stones were squished together to where this material oozed out. Very interesting. Well, Egyptologists have an answer for absolutely everything about the Great Pyramid, yet they can't demonstrate any of these required engineering feats even one time. So they're quite, to me, they're quite suspect. If I may be so bold, sciences, just like clothing fashion, come and they go. The best example is phrenology, which studied the bumps on people's heads to determine their psychological issues. And that science was prominent in the, well, like the 1910 or whatever. You could go to college and get your degree in that, phrenology. Well, it has ceased to exist because its findings cannot be supported by the scientific method. In the 21st century, we have a similar science. Egyptology is the phrenology of the 21st century because it makes a bunch of claims, but then it is incapable of engaging the scientific method to demonstrate their claims, to give it substantiation. So when an Egyptologist says, well, this pyramid was built before that pyramid, they can't even move a casing stone. So, you know, okay. they you know, you give them the...
Exactly. We're running out of time, and I'm sorry for all the people out there in the chat room. I haven't been paying y'all any attention. I apologize, but there's a couple questions in there. How did the water rise at each level to raise the boulders? That's a simple one.
Okay. The lower passages and chamber was similar to a hydraulic ram water pump. That supplied water to keep the pond that is impounded by the casing stones full, and it supplied water for the water locks. Just like in the Panama Canal or the Erie Canal, stones on barges went up to the building site from the Nile River, and still on barges went up a series of water locks up the side of the building. There's a picture of that on our website. And then into that, what we call a construction pond, impounded by the casing stones. And that's how they got to the level that they needed to go.
Well, yeah, and they use water locks in the Panama Canal, too, so it's...
Yes.
How did the water rise? That's one question. So was a fountain? Blah, blah, blah. When was the tunnels built? After the water was drained out?
No, it was built level by level.
Okay.
The passages in the bedrock was dug before the Great Pyramid was built. Then they built it level by level. Built the passages at the same level as the rest of the building. And that's
right.
Described in the book.
It is. It really, really is. Stephen, there's. Thank you for addressing the bonding agent. What about, you know, the water, how is that water taken all the way up to the capstone level? Because that's 45 stories high. I mean, it gets to a point in time where it's dysfunctional, the water lock system.
Yes, the pond on the gets on the construction pond. You know, as the pyramid gets built, or that pond gets smaller and smaller. Well, we think that towards the last few levels near the capstone, they built a temporary wall around. It's illustrated in the book, easier than describing. But they built a temporary wall and was able to finish the last few levels. So.
Okay, then they said that makes sense.
Yeah, and it's described better in the book. So.
And now the pump itself, this construction pump, what was that made out of?
Okay, that was similar, again, to a hydraulic ram water pump, but a little bit different. And it incorporated the subterranean chamber and the descending passage and associated passages under the solid bedrock, and water moved up through the grotto and up into the mound that the Great Pyramid is built on. There's a passage that leads up, and it leads up to the bottom of the Grand Gallery.
Well, you know, this, unfortunately, we're almost out of time, Stephen. It's really, really gone by quickly, and we've just barely scratched the surface of this the lost technologies of the Great Pyramid, which is, it's a great read, and I encourage anyone who's interested, not just in the pyramids, but challenging today's worldview and academia and just pretty much the worldview, how you look at things in the world, to open your eyes to a new way of thinking. And that's always it's always important, because it helps you, keeps your mind fresh.
Well, I appreciate that.
You're welcome very much. Your if you don't mind ending with your story with your father in the pump in the desert, I think that would be really appropriate.
Okay. Yeah, I was in the desert down in Southern California where I grew up. My father and I were camping, our family. Well, we took a walk, and I seen this hunk of metal on the ground. And my father was tremendously wise, certainly beyond my years. But anyway, to make a long story short, we found this hunk of metal, and I told my dad, I just asked him, I was young, probably in my early teens, I said, well, what's this hunk of garbage doing here? And he says, that's a water pump. I said, oh, no, it can't be a water pump. He says, how come? I said, well, there's no water near it. And he says, there was water when it was being used as a water pump. I said, oh, no, it can't be a water pump. He says, how come? I said, look at it. It can't pump water. And he says, oh, it pumped water when it was a water pump, when it was functional. So I said, oh, no, it can't be a water pump. And he says, how come? And he says, well, because there's no uses for the water. We were out in the middle of the desert. I mean, there was nothing. And he says, oh, it's a water pump, trust me. And I said, oh, it can't be a water pump, because the people that lived here, there was Indians that lived there, you know, before the white people. And he says, they can't make a water pump. So it can't be a water pump. And he says, he served in World War II. He said that it was from one of Patton's tanks that practiced in that era in the late 30s, and it was still there. And it was used to keep the tank's engine at the temperature it needed to be. So people can say it's not the Great Pyramid isn't a water pump, but they need to stretch their minds, and they need to understand the value of this ancient technology that's not apparent to the modern world, but it's still there. Just like penicillin wasn't apparent to the world that when it was first developed. Just like alternating current wasn't apparent when it was being developed. Nikola Tesla's college professor says, oh, no, it's not going to work. So if you want to go by the experts, then they are often the last people to understand. So I advise people to get a hold of the book and read it, and they, like you, may stretch their minds some.
Well, I appreciate you very, very much for writing this book, and I hear you're in the process of a second book, follow-up?
There's certainly our foundation has conducted quite a bit of research, and we're going to ultimately compile that research into another book, and hopefully that'll work out in the future sometime.
Now, everyone has a mentor. There's only 5 minutes left, and I would be really interested to know about what you know about your mentor, Edward Kunkel, and how he came to discover the Great Pyramid being a monumental and very sophisticated water pump.
He, like I say, he passed away in the mid-1980s, born in 1898, I believe. Did much of his research in the 1930s and 40s and wrote his book, Barrow's Pump, several editions. The last edition was known as the 5-star edition. But he, like myself, looked at the Great Pyramid, not at mummies or opening the mouth ceremony, but just as a technical, just in a technical way. And he understood that what Egyptologists say is incorrect, that it is wrong, and then searched for another answer and came up with the idea that the Great Pyramid was a water pump, and he did all he could with the limited resources he had. He died a pauper and did what he could do to tell the world about this ancient technology and how it can help the world even then. But the immediacy and the importance of this ancient technology in our world is even more important. So he was, I never met the man, but he was a tremendous influence on my life, certainly. If you can ever get, it's out of print, but if anyone can get a copy of his book, I would sure recommend it. Actually, it's a little bit more technical than mine, if you want to get technical about it. But he was in this, certainly my father was a mentor and some other people, but in terms of this research, he was my mentor.
What did you see, how can, at the time that the Great Pyramid was fully functional, what do you see, how did it help the society of the time?
The largest structure in North America is a self-powered water pump. The most expensive structure that was ever built in North America is the Grand Coulee Dam. Its primary purpose is to irrigate central Washington. It is a self-enclosed water pump, and it changed certainly the region, but a lot of people eat fruit and produce that was irrigated by this pumped water and don't even understand it. What the water was used for is probably to power industrial machinery, to make compressed air, to certainly irrigate, and a whole host of reasons. I see the Giza Plateau as an industrial park more than a necropolis. So there was a lot of uses for the pumped water, certainly. We use elevated water. A hydroelectric dam goes across a river, and then that elevates the water. We use that elevated water to make electricity, especially out here in the Pacific Northwest.
Steven,
if we can have an alternative for making electricity, it would make a big difference in our world.
You have 30 seconds. If you could leave the listening audience, if you could leave the listeners with your last words of wisdom, please.
Well, go to our website, www.thepump.org, and send me an email. Ask a question. There's a lot of things you can do to get involved. Just put a link from your site to our site or anything. So, again, thank you for this opportunity, and I really appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. Stephen Myers, again. Lost Technologies of the Great Pyramid, How the Great Pyramid Was Built. Thank you so much for coming on to 6 Degrees. Good night.
Good night.
Thanks for joining us. We'll be back again next week with another great show of 6 Degrees.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them blue for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I think